Welcome to the Unforgiving 60 with your hosts, Ben Pronk and Tim Curtis. Two ex-SAS guys armed with MBAs, seeking out people who are leading lives less ordinary in order to find out how they fill their unforgiving minutes and what helps them go always a little further.
Welcome back to the Unforgiving 60 podcast. I'm Tim Curtis with my co-host, Ben Pronk.
G'day, Tim.
Ben, today we've got Mark Walling on the show, telling his story, which starts difficult times with his father and a challenging relationship with his father.
Goes into a period of surfing and drugs.
Mm-hmm. Then finds music and martial arts, mm-hmm. which gave him some guidance, which gave him some structure, and importantly taught him some discipline.
And then quite almost by chance, Mark finds himself in a remote community in outback Australia,
mm-hmm.
dealing with Indigenous people, including some of the last of the first contact Australian Aborigines.
A story not without loss in that little journey into remote communities. Mm-hmm. He has studied extensively in academia and, in fact, is doing some deeper thinking in academia, and now he's making a contribution far more locally, Ben.
He's giving back. He's running a boxing program in a less privileged part of Perth to some kids facing some difficulties, including Indigenous Australian kids. And through that, he's teaching exactly those same things that he found through his own martial arts experience.
It's the Trojan horse.
Yep.
He is using this particular program for underprivileged and wayward kids to teach things that they really need to know that's going to keep them ultimately out of juvenile justice.
And as we'll talk about in a future episode, he also gave me a bit of a touching up in the process.
And that's another story. Let's get on with this show. Let's get on with the show.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Unforgiving 60. Now, we're sitting around a campfire for this episode. Can probably hear a bit of the ambiance of the outdoor setting, but the reason we're doing that is because we're very privileged to have been invited around by our guest this week, Mark Walling. Mark, g'day.
How are you?
I'm very well.
Thanks for having me.
We're doubly privileged to be joined not only by Mark but also by Monsieur Sans Tattoo, who we had the pleasure of speaking to just recently, and who's graces with his presence again. Sans, comment ça va?
It's a pleasure to be back, gentlemen.
And we're triply privileged to be graced by Tim Curtis also.
Tim is here as well. Yeah. I forgot to mention that. It almost goes without saying that, as always, joined by my co-host Tim. Mark, we've got a whole bunch of things we want to talk about, but it'd be really good if you could provide a bit of your background and sort of where you came from, how you got to where you are today to set the scene.
Sure. I was born in Narracourt in South Australia, and then I grew up in Adelaide. And from a sort of pretty average working class family, and none of my family had ever been to university before or anything like that, we moved to the coast when I was just turning, I think, 13, 14. And so that's when I first discovered surfing, and that became a huge part of my early life and led to lots of misadventures. But also, around that time, I discovered martial arts as well when I was about 15, and that would sort of changed my life. That campfire is really smoky.
It would not be a conversation around a campfire without bleeding from the eyes with smoke.
That's my poor campfire skills. I had a bit of a troubled family life. I was very close to my mother, but troubled life with my father. And I left home when I was 16, and left school at the end of year 11. I lied about my age and said I was 18, and I got a job as a ski lift operator at Falls Creek. But I was thinking I had to go home and maybe do a trade and get a qualification. So I went back and ended up getting a trade as a carpenter. And it was during my apprenticeship when I discovered, really got into music. And I remember just absolutely falling in love with it. And around guitar particularly, and sitting in the lunch shed, and I was scrawling away trying to teach myself music theory, and these blokes looking at their, reading their porn magazines and their paper and going, what are you, a poofter or something like that, and what are you doing there, and just really giving me a hard time about it. And I just persevered, and I think I was approaching 18. I'd got my first black belt in Taekwondo at that time, and had some back at that time. Taekwondo was a pretty tough school, and a lot of those guys are out street fighting and testing their skills in the street. So I got taught the hard way, and that gave me a lot of confidence, where coming from a family where my father was drinking, there was quite a lot of violence and a lot of unpredictability, and at times my father could be quite generous and funny, but then there'd be that switch.
Was that a reason why you got involved in martial arts, so you could defend yourself?
Yeah, I think it was. I remember being bullied at school a bit, and then a friend of mine who was actually a bodybuilder, this young guy, he was doing Taekwondo and he had this extraordinary skill. He said, "Why don't you come along and do some training?" And so I went along, and being someone who was very quiet, I found I was actually really good at it, and so it really improved my confidence.
And I was going to ask, do you think having that confidence from Taekwondo helped you stay on that path of your passion for music, even when it must have been hard? I mean, people are saying, you know, like this wasn't a normal path for someone doing an apprenticeship.
Even as a boy, I'd seen through all the parties I got taken to and just left as kids in the corner. You'd see how alcohol would change people, and people weren't what they said they were. And I realised that, and I think that's right. I was telling you that story of my father's side, grandfather. So he was 92, and there was this time he said, my father said to me, "Look, come on, we're going to go and visit your grandfather." He was staying in a hospice, was in Glenelg, which is this multi-story building. Anyway, we go up there, and my grandfather is sitting on the side of his bed. I remember this really clearly, and there was a photo of his father on the wall above his bed, and my father was sitting in a chair next to him, and I was just sitting in another chair. And my grandfather was weeping, and my father said to him, "What are you weeping about?" I said, "Oh, I'm remembering the violence of my father against me, because he was an alcoholic and extremely violent, and he used to own a pub on the Murray River, and he was notorious." And then my father received this terrible violence from his father, and I'd received this violence from my father, and that was a big turning point for me. It was a point of saying, well, at one point I said, well, I'm well and truly fucked, there's no hope for me. But I think my training, and I'd always been curious, and I'd always wanted to read and to learn, and I just switched, and it was about, well, I'm not going to let this happen to me. I'm going to stop this cycle here. And I think it was had a big effect on I tried to be proactive and positive, but also had a big effect on, in a more negative way, in my relationships, where I think I probably would have had kids younger if I hadn't had this effect.
Yeah.
But that was a pivotal moment.
My father used to always play the oldies station, and whenever, do you know that Cats in the Cradle song, that Harry Chapin song, talks about that sort of generational, not about violence, but you know, about a dad being too busy to play with his kid, and then the kid graduates from school, and dad says, "I'd love to catch up," and he said, "Oh yeah, I'm flat out, dad. You know, I'd love to, dad, if I can find the time." And he always used to turn that song up, and I always remember, well, at the time I just thought he liked the song, but I reckon it was him trying to jog his memory. These things do happen in cycles, don't they? You know, that what you see from your parents, you often, it's hard to break out of that.
They do, and that's also, I guess, why it's led to me working really over this whole span of my life with disadvantaged young people on and off. But also, it's a generational thing. And I think there's a generation of men from my generation, but also the one, your generation coming up, where we have much more access to more information, more learning. People are much more open, and we're having better conversations. And so my view these days is I take a compassion-based approach. And I know my father tried to do the right thing, and he would do the swabble. So he did try and take us camping and do all these fun things, and he just didn't have the tools, the language skills, and the communication skills, and the knowledge that's available to us now.
What was it about music at that time that captivated you? What sort of drove you to follow it with that sort of passion?
Yeah, I remember, and this is actually a good segue into what happens later, but I remember some friends of my father coming around. These are these young guys, and they'd just been travelling, done the backpack trip around the world, and they came over and they're telling me about, showing us photos, the slides, and the great travel they'd done. But then one of them left some King Crimson albums, and I remember playing these, and I remember hearing, it was like the guitar particularly was going right through me, where I sort of became the notes in the music. It was really a really powerful feeling, and I didn't quite understand what was happening at that time until later on, when a friend said, "Oh, here's a guitar, have a go on that." And I remember sitting in my bed trying to learn Smoke on the Water like everyone does.
You know, mandatory first guitar riff.
Yeah, yeah.
Deep Purple.
That's right. And, you know, later you do Stairway to Heaven and all that stuff. But it was a profound connection with music. And then as I learnt more about it and became more educated and sophisticated with it, and that world opened up. So within, I think it was 2 or 3 years, I got into the Conservatorium of Music in Adelaide, Elder Conservatorium. And then another funny story is, I remember watching TV with my dad one night, and there was a story about on 60 Minutes about the Victorian College of the Arts. And my dad's saying, "Oh, wow, look, that's the all really good there," because at the time it was like the equivalent to the Juilliard School in Australia. Yep. So I thought, I'm going to try and get in there. And so I auditioned for that. And I remember I went back to Adelaide, and it was summer, and I got a phone call, and they said, "Oh, congratulations, you've been accepted." I remember going down the beach and my father laying on a beach towel because we'd lived close to the beach. I said, "Oh, you know, by the way, I've got into the College of the Arts," and he was, "Oh, that's the one that was on TV." So, because, you know, my whole family was uneducated, so, and that began another adventure there. And
before we leave that, greatest guitar riff of all time?
Oh, that's a tough question. I'd have to say Whole Lot of Love, Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. That is just, no, I'm not singing it, but you have to pay royalties.
Now, Mark, you've talked about a lot of wayward people that have been in your life, people that fell off the rails, you know, fell into bad company, bad lifestyles. How much do you think that the discipline of what you did in martial arts and then focusing on music has helped you?
Yeah, look, I did my share of drugs and drinking, and I think if it wasn't for martial arts, I'd be dead. And that discipline, because that's the lesson I learnt. There's no freedom without discipline. And there was the myth of the late 60s, you know, the flower power generation and the LSD generation. But what they didn't understand is that you can't have freedom without that a disciplined approach even to a creative process, you know, if you want to be an artist.
That's super interesting. Tim, you've said before, you know, this idea of happiness is a construct that, you know, really you can't achieve anything worthwhile without a struggle. You need to have a yin to the yang. You can't just have a chemically induced happiness of any meaning.
That's right. It's all about the journey. And that's why I love the SAS motto. It's such a simple little phrase, but it's true. It's about whether you're a visual artist or a martial artist or you're trying out for selection with the SAS or a musician, a writer, a lawyer, whatever, you can just do something average or you can just push yourself that bit further. And you get the return. So energy begets energy. I don't mean energy in the hippie sense, but the effort begets a return, and you see that, I think.
And Sons, in our discussion, you spoke about those daily investments. You know, you reap a dividend, but it's no sort of one silver bullet. It's this daily investment in different aspects.
It's that what we touched on earlier when in the previous interview when we were talking about what's the secret.
Yeah.
There is no secret, and what you're expressing and what I'm hearing is just another form or an expression of the need for sweat, and discipline is.
Yeah.
You know, like you put your head down and you focus and you keep doing it, and then over time you do move a little bit further forward.
Did you end up going to the Victorian College of the Arts?
I did, yeah. I went there for a few years, and that was phenomenal. You know, I remember going into their music library. You know, still records back then, and that's when I just complete. I've always did like jazz, but I didn't. I was quite ignorant about it, who was who and what, why it was so good. And I remember putting on John Coltrane's My Favorite Things, and just sitting in my chair with my headphones on, just going, what? It was just the original. I think it was, I'm going to get into trouble for this, in the mid-60s, I think it was, 63, 64. I might be wrong. Sorry, if jazz fans. my memory's not serving me.
Do we have a demographic of jazz fans?
Jazz fans form a big chunk of our listeners.
I'd say definitely jazz hands.
Yeah, I don't think
we can talk about the jazz hands later. PCYC.
Yeah. Okay, so from the beach towel to the beach, telling your dad that you're going to VCA, into VCA for a couple of years.
Yes.
What happened next?
I finished, and I was in Melbourne, and I was playing and teaching music, and a friend of mine. It's going to be a bit of a double story here, but a friend of mine rang up and said, "I've just been got a grant for 2 weeks to teach music at an Indigenous Aboriginal community called Kintore. Do you want to come along? Because I feel a bit nervous about doing it. Come and help me. And why don't we keep travelling once we get up there? So we'll go and earn some money and maybe do a bit more work around the place, and we'll go up there." That was my first time travelling overseas, and I remember we bought the tickets because we just flew to Kupang and West Timor. Mm-hmm. This was at a time when it's mid-80s, so it's still very tense. East Timor wasn't independent, so the Indonesian military was still very strong and couldn't go to East Timor, and West Timor was very sensitive still. And I remember sitting on the plane and going, you know, seeing Australia disappear and going over the sea for the first time, you know, that young fella excitement. Anyway, we landed there, and we were going to then get the ferry and hop through the islands. Someone in Darwin, actually at the youth hostel, said, "Oh, you take some balloons over, because the kids over there love balloons. You can blow them up and muck around." And so we're walking to the ferry, and it was this beautiful still day, tropical day, not a breath of wind, perfect blue skies, and there's two brothers. One boy was about probably 4 or 5, and another boy is probably about a few years old, maybe 8 or 9. And so we were sort of talking to them in our sort of pidgin Bahasa Indonesia, and I blew up their spleen, and there was it was on the edge on the coast. So there was a sea wall, a stone wall, and this tree, because as you saw in that photo, I blew up the balloon, and he was really shy, and he had his little Indonesian shorts and school uniform on, the youngest, and he kept going, oh, and he'd go to get it, and he'd take it away. And then he stepped back onto the road, and this motorcycle scooter came hurtling around, just plowed straight into him. And I can still see it now, it's clear as day, this little kid cartwheeling in the air, fully outstretched. And then he landed on his head on the road, and this guy on a scooter fell off, and his helmet went scooting off. And we just ran over, and I remember I didn't want to move him because I thought he maybe had damaged his neck or his spine, but I remember just nursing his head. And it was like his forehead was being pumped up by a bike pump, and it became really swollen, distended before me, and he was bleeding out his ears and his nose and his mouth. And I can still see his eyes looking at me, just like this sense of what's going on. And then just saw that light go out, and he died in my arms. And just to make matters worse, like, we're in shock, and then there's this woman screaming. It was his mother, so I saw her tearing up the road and just screaming, and she just scooped him up and jumped in the back of a BMO and took off. And then the world just went back to normal, and we're back to this beautiful day and the light winds and the blue skies and the birds tweeting. And I had the presence of mind to say to my friend who was in deep shock, and said, look, let's just stay calm, let's get our backpacks, and let's just keep walking. Because it was at a time, and I guess it sounds kind of callous perhaps in retrospect, but it was at a time where if we'd gone to the police or to the hospital, we would have been thrown in jail and probably blamed for the accident, I guess.
So you have a framed photograph of that boy.
Yeah.
Why do you have that photo?
Because it's a way of... I feel like he's part of the family, but it's a way of me coming to terms with a deep trauma that which is, I think, is a good part of the discussion, is that these things have a way of, when you're a young boy, it's like a fellow, you just kind of go, oh, that was awful, but you press on and you keep doing it. And what happened when I became a parent and I had kids, that became this awful triangulated, it was like a spinning ball, and that horrible accident would just become multifaceted. And I couldn't sleep. I'd think about that mother, and I think about his brother, and think about, you know, should I have done something else? I used to blame myself for it. And and so I had to do, it was kind of, and there was other things that happened later on in life that was kind of manifested. And so I had to sort of come to terms with that and find some compassion for myself and find a way to integrate that and accept it, and find a way of coming to acceptance that it was an awful accident. And you know, we were young, and it was just this terrible thing that happened,
and something that I imagine just makes no sense. There's no sort of karmic reason why that should have happened.
No,
it was just I imagine it'd be difficult to reconcile because of that, but these things do occur, don't they? There's no rhyme or reason.
They do, and so that's why that photo says. So now, you know, I sometimes say good morning to him. You know, like I can have that there, and I feel like there's a sense of reconciliation and peace there. That it's something that happened, and I've managed to find a way to come to terms with it. I still have times where there's been t- times where I was at a meeting a few weeks ago, and there's a mum there with a little kid, and the kid was two or three and kept running towards the road. And I've done this. I've gone up and sit, people think I'm crazy. Okay. I say, look, can you just keep an eye on that child for me? Because it's, you know, the accidents happen really quick. And but most of the time, I'll just, you know, use the breath and I'll get some perspective, and it's cool. But sometimes it'll trigger. But generally, it's you just accept that that's one of those terrible, as you say, terrible things that happen. And for every one of those, there's sort of 10, you know, good things that's happened in my life. So
you mentioned breathing. Is that a control for you that you use?
Yeah.
Often?
Yeah, look, it comes down to being a real mental game in the end, particularly as you get older. And I find breath is just critical. So I when I'm teaching the boys at boxing and so forth, I talk to them a lot about breath. I have a daily practice in the mornings, you know, like a moving meditation, standing meditation type thing. And there's nothing cosmic about it. It's breathing, you know. It's just taking in good breaths and having that situational awareness, self-awareness, and just you're able to detach yourself and get a perspective of what's going on.
But I reckon that's really powerful. And Sons, you spoke in our last discussion about that recognition of physiological aspects, that if you weren't aware, then all of a sudden you're just overwhelmed with emotion, or you think, I can't do this, or this isn't me, or I can't do confrontation, as we discussed. But having something tangible, a physical element like breath,
and the science has proved that too.
That's a way of being able to get in front of those mysterious, awful emotions.
Yeah, and look, taking a compassion-based approach, I don't mean compassion in the kind of hippie sense, but as a working tool, I've had a terrible experience. I've had a number of terrible experiences, but so has everybody, you know. And you've had people on your program that have had horrific experiences. And so I think if you, through breath and that meditative practice, you understand that's the human condition, and that you have to change it and switch it into doing something positive, I think, and not don't have self-pity, but you have compassion. You can have empathy and sympathy, but not self-pity, if that makes sense.
So let's come out of East Timor from that tragedy. And why don't we come back West Timor?
Yeah.
From that tragedy. Why don't we come home into the beautiful red sands of outback Australia? Can you talk about how you arrived in remote communities in outback Australia and your experiences there?
Yeah, sure. So, as I said, this friend of mine, long story short, we end up driving out to this community of Kintore, which is in the Western Desert. So it's 550 kilometres west of Alice Springs, just near the WNT border. And what was it was complete chaos, and it was amazing and extraordinary. And I just felt like, oh, I'm home. I just sort of felt really comfortable in that chaos.
So, sorry, had you had much to do with Aboriginal people prior to that?
No, I was complete ignoramus.
And did you have a perception about Aboriginal people? Like, did you have any sort of biases that you took into that experience, or stereotypes that...
I'd met some traditional Pitjantjatjara traditional owners had come to university, because we did some units on ethnomusicology. And I just found them really otherworldly and cryptic, and because the desert societies are so generally fairly quiet and soft-spoken, and it's hard. You find them hard to approach, and sometimes and I was, like all Australians, I had very little real education about Aboriginal history and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander history and culture and society, and ignoramus, yeah. Pinacoya, as people say, deaf, ignorant.
Right.
And so was 2 weeks ended up, I ended up getting a job there on that community and staying out there for nearly 2 years, or probably a bit shorter than that, probably 18 months, and starting to learn the language and the old men and women and family groups taking you out, teaching you to hunt. And that awakened, because as a boy I just loved, grew up watching Harry Butler, and I always wanted to be a biologist, but or a park ranger, and with my family background and the schools and so forth, it's like, oh, you're, I remember being told you're not smart enough to do that. And so it awakened that, those memories and wanting to learn more. So I went on to do a science degree and a master's in ecological science, but I kind of did that back to front. I learnt about our landscape through Aboriginal knowledge and traditional ecological knowledge first, and that taught me, well, how does Western society view a landscape, and how do we interpret it, and how do we name things, and just led to that whole journey. And to put that into context with music, I remember going back to the Esplanade in Hotel in Melbourne, and leaning on the bar having a beer, watching a band. I remember looking around, and so I was 28 by this time or something. I remember looking around and seeing these guys in their sort of 40s or mid-40s and being aging hipsters. And I just thought, that's not a good look. You know, to be, and it's a hellish life being a musician sometimes. Like, I thought, at this age, you know, I don't think that's the life I want to lead. So by that time, this is where this whole incredible world, the natural world, and how cultures relate to the land and use landscapes and interact with it, and how it informs their worldview and their thinking. It just grew and grew and grew, and yeah.
It's interesting because it's academically back to front. You started on the land.
Story of my life.
Right. You started on the land, learnt about the land, and then put your nose in the textbook.
Yeah.
Most people would do it the other way around.
That's right, and that's why I've started doing some writing about it, because what happened is these old guys would take me out, and we would follow behind them. They'd make you walk single file behind them, and they would narrate the story of what was happening on that particular dune system, what had happened that night. And so they'd be reading the tracks and looking at scratchings on the side of a tree, or a little herbaceous flower had been nibbled or something, and another set of tracks had come through. And I realised this was the literature for them of their world, and that there was this incredibly rich storytelling, and their knowledge of their landscape was mind-boggling. People being able to track over stone, and I'm still not sure how they did that.
Mark, sorry, we've spoken in a previous episode about Sebastian Junger's book about tribe, which talks a lot about modern Western society, and in fact, Sons, in our discussion earlier, we spoke about sort of resilience in our society and some of the, I guess, more negative aspects of what we're seeing in contemporary Western society. Are there any lessons that you learnt from what you saw while living with the peoples in outback Australia that you think we could take away in our modern society?
Yeah, do with less, be happier with less. I think there's a lot of myths about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people, they're all alcoholics and so forth, and it's just complete fallacy. And again, it's not my place to talk about Aboriginal society as a representative. I'm just talking about my experiences. But people were really happy generally, and there was a sense of family, strong sense of family. Not all the time. There's a lot of dysfunction, but there was also at that time there was a very strong journey that young men could make to manhood, and that's not my place to talk about that, but and I think we've lost that in our society. And that whole notion of Tim, toughness, not fitness, you know, if I can draw from one of your thoughts.
I think I stole that.
Did you? Like,
but I'll take it.
Yeah, okay. It's good, Tim.
Take hold of that. Who's that?
One of Tim's two thoughts. No, I thought Tim said it as well. It's good. But I think that's really an interesting point, because we're seeing what's been referred to as a toxic masculinity, that the idea of being a strong male has been perverted to these sort of stereotypes, and I think there's a backlash against that, and I think it disempowers young men, and there's a lot of confusion about what it means to be a man and what it means to be strong as a man in our society.
I was very fortunate to spend a lot of time, I mean talking like 10 years on and off, working with the last of the pre-contact generation. So this is a generation of men who grew up pre-white contact and grew a traditional life. And so if you want to take that concept of resilience and toughness and the warrior, these guys were warriors. They were, you know, they'd all had various fights and so forth, and they'd had to survive in extraordinarily difficult conditions. But there's also this incredible softness and humour and gentleness about them. And so this is where I think in white society we've kind of got it mixed up, where toughness has to be this kind of, you know, the condom stuff full of walnuts kind of look, you know, where you're this big buff guy and you have no emotions and you sort of use violence to solve your problems. And that's why I think it's fantastic you guys are doing this podcast, and there's others that are starting to talk about this and build that community of men and start to have that conversation, because it creates a brittleness, a psychological brittleness, and that sort of defeats resilience. Really need that sort of bamboo quality. Mm.
How important do you think are role models, positive male role models, in this equation? You spoke about your own, well, the generational cycle of, yeah, you know, potentially alcoholism and violence. You arguably might not have grown up seeing what right looked like. I mean, for you personally, did you have a mentor or a role model outside of your father that taught you what a good man?
I was going to say no, but then when I think about it, what I developed mentors at a distance or role models at a distance. So I'd see other men within that families, friends and so forth, who you'd see how they were with their kids and go, oh, hang on, that's kind of weird. And then you realise that's normal. So, and then I had some fantastic martial art teachers who were just exceptional people. And so that's something I've always done. I've always sought role models at a distance, or you look at how people are in the world and you go, well, that's really interesting, and you kind of think about that and analyse that. Mm. And yeah, that's what's kind of led to sort of some of the work I've been doing.
So let's come back home with the beautiful Australian outback red dust in the welts of your boots.
Yep.
And let's come into the gym.
Yes.
And discuss some of that work.
Sure.
Can you talk to us about that gym and what you are doing there?
Yeah, I teach boxing to disadvantaged young men, or young men at risk, in conjunction with the WA police. And that's part of a program to really work with this cohort who they're not in the juvenile justice system, but they are flirting with it, and they are at risk. And just to provide them and with the opportunity to have a safe, fun space, a space where they can come to a few hours a week and work hard and see that to give them a system to achieve their goals. So we break down into these mini goals. Well, first you actually have to do a good push-up first. And And it's also a space where they can actually just have some time out from, because a lot of them are from chaotic families. And so what I do is use that program to actually sneak in things like breathing and meditation. They don't actually realize they're doing it. And that's where we have the fantastic Chris Collard comes in when he's not on FIFO once a month or so, and works with the boys. He's a pro fighter. He's had 70 fights and is the world's first Indigenous world champ, kickboxing champion.
And for our listeners, bookmark that, because we've got a time lined up to speak with Chris, and I'm super interested in unpacking his story. You know, but in the forefront of my mind when I was asking that question about role models was a guy like Chris in that environment. So yeah, we will speak with Chris and get a bit more detail on that.
And you've got it bookmarked in your medical file because he cracked your rib.
Sons,
what do you say?
Well, when I heard that story of Ben getting into the ring with someone of his caliber, it actually put a very large smile on my face. It doesn't say a lot about my personality, but I was pleased to think that someone of Ben's background and intellect could do something so stupid.
Well, I do love your saying, never box a boxer, never wrestle a wrestler.
You always do what they don't do.
Exactly.
Because if you lack the athletic ability or talent, in this case, the only way that you have the beginning of a chance of success is to be different.
That's right. And I have listened on this very podcast to Ben saying that in our time in the SAS, we never liked a fair fight.
Surfaces and gaps.
Yeah, Queensbury rules, any jumps with a world champion boxer and wonders why he's now got a bookmark in his medical file.
We might explore that story in a little more depth when we speak with Chris. But yes, I made the mistake of getting in the ring with him, and he was extremely... I think gentle on me and still managed to give me a touching up, which speaks to the caliber of fighter.
Chris is one of those guys who just is a natural hard hitter, and he sometimes just he can't help himself, even if he's just playing with you. But I think it's worthwhile for our listeners. Like, let's talk about that for a bit, because what I witnessed was it was a really interesting fight. Because, as we were saying before, I think I saw you you'd get outboxed sometimes, but as Chris said, you always came forward, and I just saw it as leadership in action. You were always coming back on the offensive. You were going a little further. You never gave up, and I felt like you were. You're 12 months or so out of the SAS, and you were working out a puzzle for yourself. It was like I saw you trying to solve this puzzle and benchmark for yourself in the ring. It was for me, it was fascinating.
It was very Napoleonic. You just stupidly went forward.
Mark, your expression is so much more gentle and compassionate. Tim comes in like a blunt axe. Yeah.
I admired Tim's technique of boxing from outside the ring.
I was looking at surfaces and gaps. I'd identified the fire extinguisher that if he decided he wanted me to get in the ring, I was taking that fire extinguisher with me using all available weapons.
It was good. I think I've said on this podcast before that it's probably good for the soul in a controlled environment every now and then to get punched in the face and put back in your box. And I certainly did that. In fact, I think I could read the manufacturing details of the headgear I was wearing for about a week. It was imprinted on my head in addition to nursing a fractured rib.
But what a tremendous individual. And Chris Collard, he is genuinely a tremendous young man. And I do say young when we consider the age around this table, but just profound humility.
Yeah, he is.
He's always seeking some form of self-improvement, even though he's a world champion.
Yeah, look, he's... I think I was saying to you when I told him you guys were coming down, the first thing he said to me was, oh, fantastic, I can learn a lot from these guys. And he was really excited. And he's currently training for a... I mean, he will tell you this himself, it's for him to tell, but he's currently training for a UFC fight. He just wants to do a couple of those before he finishes.
And he's 42 years old? 46, okay.
Look, before we get off this topic, one thing that's important, I think, that is I'm seeing is getting... When I get the boys in the ring, I do a... I do a lot of work with them. I get them moving straight away. And so for those listeners who aren't familiar with the combat arts, it's not beating each other up. We do a lot of really light sparring, no gloves, and it's just touch the shoulder or the knee, moving around. And then I put the headgear on them, and I put their mouth guards in, and we'll do more light sparring, because when you put headgear on a mouth guard, it's really, it's uncomfortable, and it's kind of scary at first if you're not used to it. And what I do, again, it's a trick, is I use that space of the ring to get them to be present in the moment. Because what I'm noticing with these, and now we've opened it up to, so anybody's interested in coming down can come and train. And I'm really noticing that this generation, it's really hard to get them to be in the moment. So I will be getting them and holding them and looking them direct in the eyes and saying, where have you gone? Where are you? Mm. Come back, be here with me, come on. Mm. And then all of a sudden, you'll see them come into the ring, and they'll, their demeanor will change and they'll be present, and then we'll keep moving. And so simple little tricks like that, where kids, these young boys are so distracted with technology and troubled families and all these escape routes, they never have this moment where they're actually with themselves and present. It's quite powerful.
So I have to ask the question that a critic would ask.
Yeah.
How is teaching them violence
Yeah.
going to make them better in their current situation?
Yeah, I'd actually hope you'd ask that, because I think there's a fundamental misunderstanding of boxing. If you're a pro or amateur boxer, sure, your headgear off, gloves on, and you're going to go and fight them. What we're doing is using it as a bit of subterfuge to give them structure, and I do a bit of mindful stretching with them, a bit of yoga. I do meditation. I do mobility exercises. We do BJJ drills, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, grappling. And I'm teaching them about how to take that first micro step to achieve a simple goal. Like, can you do a perfect push-up? Can you do a perfect burpee? Can you do a proper stretch? And so you use a series of techniques to get them to actually think about that well, I achieved this goal. And then the next time they come back, they do 10 push-ups, or they do 10 sit-ups, or their fitness is better. And we're seeing marked change. The WA police have said that they've seen a decline in petty crimes and violence amongst this cohort. We're seeing this marked improvement in their schooling. And I have to give a big shout out to the people at the all PCYCs, but particular Frio PCYC, because they run a great breakfast program for young kids. Mm-hmm. My wife actually works in that breakfast program, and there's a whole lot of great youth workers that work with that group, and then work with the kids at the various schools around the place. So there's a whole community of us that are working with them at different times of the day. So. And that's kind of a long answer to your question.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Okay. It's a good one. Changing topic. Can we come out of the gym? Right at the start of the podcast, Mark, you mentioned reading and the importance of your investment in reading as a young fellow. We've enjoyed reading your blog, which is beautifully written.
Thank you.
Probably does reflect the fact that you're very well read and can tell a very animated story.
Yeah.
Can you talk to us about the blog? How did that start, and how much of a role does it now play in your life?
Yeah, my blog's pretty ad hoc. I kind of don't believe in putting up a blog just for the sake of it, because I need to do it each week. Rather, it's when I feel like there's a piece that's ready to go on. And so it's called Movement as a Story, and it's based around the notion from Bruce Chatwin, the writer who he's since died, but he's written some fantastic books about the first notion of humanity was to move. That the language started through song and movement, and our whole culture evolved through movement and song. And so it's really looking at how even movement in its simplest form, like Nick Haywood from the Mill Gym?
Nick Caldwell,
that great interview, and he spoke about get out of bed, make your bed. And so he does this first movement each day and sets his routine. So it's writing about how we are genetically wired to be constantly moving, and we have this culture now where we just sit all the time. And it's also taking that sort of more macro scale of looking at how different cultures move through a landscape or interpret their world through movement. And so it's pretty broad. And it's just an interest of mine, and that blog is part of a process. It's part of a journey I've started now where I work for myself, and I felt I needed to get back to in touch with creative work. And I'm starting to write a book about my time working in the Western Desert. Yeah, it's really interesting. It's really rewarding, but it's part of just start doing it. Start doing the work, start writing, and then it leads to all these things. It's kind of, in a way, led to this conversation with you guys, and hopefully I will get this book finished quite soon.
How do people find the blog, Mark?
You can just Google movementasastory.com and you'll find it there. And I'll be happy. There's no cost or anything. Just happy for you to subscribe, and you won't get annoyed too much. Every now and a couple of weeks, something will turn up.
That's great. It's easy reading. It's very humorous. It's beautifully written. And you can read the story about the man in the red undies, which I cackled myself silly when I read the title.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark, you've spoken a lot this afternoon about, I guess, these near misses, friends of yours who have had, you know, disastrous results. And in fact, Sons, when we spoke, you talked about your extremely interesting life or parts thereof, and hitchhiking from Johannesburg to Pretoria, which we joked later is not on DFAT's recommended sort of travel.
Well done, Ben, for weaving that in.
I got that
you missed
in.
It the first time, but you've engineered the second structure, yes.
The question I've got for both of you, and maybe you first, Mark, do you believe in luck?
Yes and no, but I think I think that you create it. That goes back to what I was saying about energy begets energy. So effort brings
The harder I work, the luckier I get.
And so this is what I've found by, like, I have a business partner in Malaysia, and we're building this business, and we wouldn't have got to this point without the prior 12 months of iterating and trying stuff out, doing this blog and writing and testing ideas, and this conversation I have with this small group is creates this conversation, creates this community, creates this luck, and it grows. And I think it's that Buddhist conception of right attitude, and if you have the right approach, and it's about service and giving back, then I think you get lucky. Yeah, it creates good vibes.
So,
my only variation where Mark said his answer was yes and no, mine would be no and yes. And I also subscribe to Gary Player's view that the harder you work, the luckier you get. That said, I think there's a degree of luck. I wouldn't say it's on a cosmic level, but you can prepare, do the work, be fortuitous, serendipity plays a part. But sometimes I think you can just be lucky. I was lucky enough to be sitting in a restaurant one day, and there was a woman at a table next to me that caught my eye. Perhaps she was unlucky because she ended up as my wife. But there's no way that I contributed to that.
Yeah.
So that was lucky.
Component of timing, perhaps?
Perhaps. You could say, well, if I hadn't gone to South Africa, I wouldn't have been in that restaurant. Mm. And it wasn't luck that I went to South Africa. It was a choice.
Mm.
But perhaps part of the reason that I went to South Africa was because I used to read Wilbur Smith novels as a young infantry soldier.
Yep.
And that influenced my decision to go to South Africa. Maybe I was lucky that I saw Wilbur Smith on the bookshelf and not Desmond Bagley.
Have you thanked Wilbur for meeting your wife?
I haven't, but perhaps I should.
Perhaps you should.
Mm. Now into academia for you, Mark. You mentioned you are an adjunct at one of the universities. Can you talk about that next chapter?
Yeah, as part of a business I've been looking at, and I've been working with a group of grads over the last couple of years on and off, in more in an informal sense, but that's now been formalised. So I've been made an adjunct senior lecturer at a particular university here in WA, and we're working to build a course for graduates that... I'm just not sure how much I'm allowed to say, but that is looking at that transition to work.
We hold the highest security clearances.
And no one listens.
Those two things make it incredibly safe to talk about whatever you can't say.
I feel safe then. That's good.
My favourite segment. Quick questions, quick answers.
Oh, yeah.
What inspires you?
I'd say music. I'd say great writing. I think my family.
Where do you find beauty?
Everywhere. I find that in the mornings when I get up and I struggle to get my old beaten body working, and I make a cup of tea and I come out and I just do some stretching, warm up, and get my body working, and then I just feel myself tune into the day, and I just feel blessed to be alive.
What challenges you?
Teenagers. What challenges me actually is normality, like just doing the same sort of job over and over again and not asking questions about why have we considered doing this a different way, or and I just find it incredibly boring when people just do that and think like that.
If you had the ear of the world for just a minute, what would you say?
Pay attention. Pay attention, and I think as Mondrian, the great artist, said, a God is in the details, and that by paying attention you become aware, self-aware, situationally aware, and that leads you to a compassionate approach to the world. And I don't know who said it, but conversation, not denigration, I think that's a fantastic phrase.
That would have been
probably
Tim.
Another one. Tim will claim it if no one jumps in.
Yeah, I think that's a really important phrase.
And one that's increasingly important. We discussed, I think, offline this afternoon about, you know, the reductionism to 7-second sound bites. We spoke about that in our conversation with you, Sons. And
this segment's called Quick Questions, Quick Answers.
Tim's attention span issues.
It's the flesh wound. It's troubling.
Okay, back to a quick question. What do you hope for your children?
Oh, that's it. I think happiness. Yeah, I know it's a dreadful cliche, but a sense of endeavour. We're trying to imbue them with do the work. And the rewards will come, and to be a decent person. And I'm very proud to say that I'm just over the moon with my 15-year-old son. I think he's sailing in a great direction, and he's this new generation from my family who's not going to suffer from what I went through, or my father or my grandfather. So,
which I think is probably a massive credit to you, Mark, whether you sort of acknowledge it or not. But I mean, that is pretty tough. You spoke that really poignant picture you painted of four generations of men in your family sitting there.
Yeah, I did feel doomed that day.
Yeah, and I mean, look where you are now with a son that's been given all the chances that you didn't have because of the efforts that you've made.
Yeah, looking back on a life half-assed, it's... Jocko Willink said something the other day, we tell ourselves lies. And I think the fantastic thing, to go back to the thing about boxing is just, or BJJ or anything like that, is amazing for you finding yourself out.
Where there's nowhere to hide, isn't
there? There is nowhere to hide. And it doesn't mean that you're beating someone to death, but you're testing. And I've just had this fantastic experience with these boys where we're sparring, some of the older boys, and I get found out all the time. We have a ball and we don't hurt each other.
Mm. And last question. If you could recommend a book, a piece of art, a poem, literature, music that someone should read, watch, listen to, what would that be?
Oh, look, I thought you might ask something like this, and I can't go past Haruki Murakami's What We Talk About When We Talk About Running. And I'd highly recommend, it's actually a book about writing, and he's probably one of my favourite writers in the world. And it's just this fabulous book that he talks about his time through his whole career, because he's probably late 60s, early 70s now, of running marathons and how he trains for them. But then he brings in the metaphor for writing and life, really. And it's very funny. He's got this wonderful sense of humour too.
Mark Walling, thanks very much for being on the Unforgiving 60 podcast.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
And special guest Sams, thank you also.
My pleasure to be here as
Double
well.
Double act today.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, gents.
Cheers.
As an end note, here's Mark and his band, Handsome Frank, with a solo acoustic recording of a track called On Me. It's a special recording for the Unforgiving 60 podcast. Here's On Me.
Dreaming of silence and empty. emptiness. You're hiding in the shadows of a crowded room. Call on me. Trust in me. Believe.
Ladies and gentlemen, that's it. Now to the debrief. Here at the Unforgiving 60, we relentlessly pursue excellence, and so we'd love to get your feedback, any insights you might have, any reflections on what we've discussed. Certainly, if you are or if you know someone who's living a life less ordinary, we'd certainly love to hear from them as well. You can get in touch with us at debrief@unforgiving60.com. That's unforgiving60.com. Of course, you can also follow us on social media. Just search up Unforgiving 60, that's 60, on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. And if you've enjoyed this podcast, please tell your friends and give us a like on iTunes. Until next time we talk, we wish you all the best, and we certainly hope that what we've discussed can help you feel your own unforgiving 60s with some quality distance run. Cheers.